So when Suzanne and I came up with the panel topics before the pandemic, little did we know that there might be quite a lot to say about digital issues for family lawyers, and it's a big topic. So this is also a big topic, and I've asked the excellent panel we've got this afternoon to choose from this big topic of divorce and financial splits and essential outline, the topics in an international context which most appeal to them and which they find the most interesting. Our panelists are, and I haven't got very long to introduce them, I'm afraid, because we've got five excellent panelists to squeeze into an hour and a quarter. Our panelists this afternoon are Dr. Agnė Limantė, who is Lithuanian, who practices out of the Law Institute of Lithuania, but is currently based in Kiev, and therefore would have spoken had we been all together. And she is a senior research fellow at the Law Institute of Lithuania. And she's going to speak about choice of jurisdiction and applicable law, which is a sort of overarching topic over the topics in the panel heading. And she's an academic rather than a practitioner, and therefore will provide us with an interesting and slightly different perspective. Sam Longworth is a partner at the international litigation firm Stewart's in London, and he is going to explain, for those of you who don't already know, how we do things differently in England with discretionary approach of English judges, and in particular will give us an interesting update on a recent Court of Appeal case about arbitration. Marie Berger is a partner at BRS Avocat in Geneva, a very well-known Geneva law firm, and like our other four practitioners, has a very busy international practice and is often sought out as a speaker on these issues. Severine Tamburini is in Aix-en-Provence, the city I wish I had done my law degree in, and is a well-known international law practitioner, a go-to person if you've got a case in the south of France. She has the advantage of having spent a large part of her life in England and therefore has a very international outlook. She, as well as the French perspective, she's going to cover a recent Court of Appeal decision of Aix-en-Provence Court, which is interesting from an international perspective. Finally, and not least, we have Irina Moroz, who is at Alga Partners in Kiev, and again would have been our other Ukrainian-based speaker had we been meeting together today. Irina is head of the Committee of Family Law and International, sorry, of Family, Civil and International Law at the Ukrainian Bar Association, and Alga Partners is a large law firm with over 50 lawyers based in Kiev. And she's going to give us the Ukrainian perspective this afternoon. So, Agnė, over to you.
Let me put my slides on. Okay, here it is. So, dear all, let me firstly thank you, warm thank you for the organizers of this event. It's an honor for me to be here and to listen to all the presentations and discussions. It is especially interesting for me as an academic, since so many practitioners share their experiences and their insights. I'm a researcher, and I recently took part in several EU-funded projects which focused on private international family law. I will talk from this perspective, and my topic today is the party autonomy to choose jurisdiction and applicable law for matrimonial property in Europe. I will focus on the analysis of the relevant rules of the European Union Matrimonial Property Regulation. This regulation, as many of you know, is a recent European Union instrument, which was adopted via enhanced cooperation procedure. At present, it applies to 18 European Union member states. I will approach party autonomy from two aspects, and in particular, I will take it from the two angles. I will talk about the right of the parties to agree on jurisdiction, and also on the parties' right to agree on the to choose the law applicable to their matrimonial property. And to start with this, let me first begin with a practical example. Suppose that a new client comes to you and says that she's interested for an advice on family law, divorce, and division of matrimonial property. She herself is Italian national and is married to a Swedish man. They met in Sweden, got married in Verona. The husband works for, let's say, a British company, and because of his job, right after their marriage, they moved to live to Baku in Azerbaijan. After a few years, the family relocates to Kiev in Ukraine, and there they reside currently. However, it is expected that in summer, the husband will be offered a contract in Asia. The family owns property in Italy, in Sweden, in United Kingdom, and this property is at issue in the case. As the relationships are getting complicated, the wife comes to you, it's asking if they could make an agreement with the husband and to state where they would divorce and how, applying what law, their matrimonial property will be settled. Actually, what she wants, at least at first sight, is a very simple thing. She wants clarity. However, in practice, it is not really so, as such agreements are complicated. For a long time, such an agreement in cross-border matters was not possible. However, rules foreseeing party autonomy are an increasing trend in national laws in many countries, and also in the European Union, private international family law instruments. To a greater or to a lesser extent, you will find party autonomy in many European Union family law regulations, such as Brussels 2A regulation, the Rome 3 regulation, matrimonial property regulation, and others. However, those who already work with those regulations will probably know that in those instruments, party autonomy varies considerably. And it might be a very hard task to find a balanced model that would fit the party's needs and desires. I will not go closely into other areas, but will only speak about the matrimonial property, as it is the main topic of our session. In European Union, as I said, it is the matrimonial property regulation, which is the main instrument in this regard. Let me say a few words as to why party autonomy is important and why it was included in the matrimonial property regulation. The situation which I have just described you a bit earlier is a good starting point to find arguments for party autonomy. Indeed, increasing mobility of citizens in Europe is our daily life now. This calls for flexibility, for greater legal certainty. This forces especially mixed couples and those living in several jurisdictions over their lifetime. They have an interest to know in advance which law will apply to their divorce and matrimonial property regime, or where their divorce and matrimonial property questions will be settled. The need to ensure predictability and stability is even more justified, having in mind that habitual residence is the primary connecting factor in our European Union regulations. Habitual residence, even if it's called habitual, in fact, is not very stable in its nature, and it changes quite easily. On the other hand, if you have parties who have chosen the law applicable to their situation, this connecting factor is more stable than habitual residence, which changes once the people move. Finally, party autonomy allows divorce case and related issues to be settled faster, avoiding litigation as to jurisdiction and applicable law. I actually saw several cases from United Kingdom, especially where parties spend years and a lot of thousands of euros litigating just over the question where to litigate, where jurisdiction is the main issue of the proceedings. So having said that, let me now move a bit further. And let me talk firstly about the possibility to choose jurisdiction in the matrimonial property regulation. It is, I have to say, firstly, it's pretty limited. The regulation seeks to concentrate jurisdiction in divorce and matrimonial property matters in one member state. And therefore, the main rule is that the courts having jurisdiction for divorce will have jurisdiction for matrimonial property. This is reflected in Article 5 of the Matrimonial Property Regulation, and only in cases when this concentration is not possible, then we go to another article of the regulation, which then sets a certain criteria for so-called cascade of connecting factors. When concentration of proceedings is not possible, when this main rule is not working, only then the parties are granted a possibility to choose the jurisdiction for their matrimonial property issues. So here we have to take into account the Article 7, which allows parties to confer jurisdiction to courts of the country whose laws applies to the substance of the matter. So again, we see the intention to concentrate the case. The second possibility to choose is the courts of the state where the marriage was concluded or was celebrated. So in general, the possibilities to choose a jurisdiction remained limited, as it is only possible to agree on jurisdiction when the concentration of jurisdiction fails. Much wider part of autonomy is, however, foreseen in cases where parties want to agree on the matrimonial property regime and applicable law to it. While as regards choice of court, the parties' will is complementary only, matrimonial property regulation makes parties' choice as the main rule for the applicable law. Only if the parties' choice was not made, the regulation foresees the rules on applicable law. This we also see in the text of regulation itself, where the article on party autonomy comes first, and only then we see the rules applicable if this fails. In accordance with the regulation, parties can choose certain laws to be applied for their matrimonial property regime. In particular, we have to note that, again, it's not a super flexible rule. So the parties can opt for the law of the state where both or one of them is habitual resident, or alternatively, they can choose the law of nationality of either party at the time the agreement is concluded. You might have noticed that there is no option of lex fori on this list. There is also no possibility to choose lex re situ for the immovable property. Moreover, the parties are not allowed to choose to choose the law of the country where they intend to settle after a certain time. The main rule, again, the regulation remains a link between the parties and the a law which they intend to be applied to their relationship. Let's go back to our case study, which I a bit earlier described. And by this, I would like to exemplify why party autonomy becomes an important and when it could be particularly relevant. I presented you a situation of Italian woman married to a Swedish man, and let's say they marry a bit later in 2019, because it's the time when the regulation comes into force. And if right after their marriage, they move to Azerbaijan, this will be the country which will be considered probably their first habitual residence. If the parties have chosen the law applicable to their matrimonial property, be it Swedish law or Italian law, according to their citizenship, that's okay, that law will be applied. However, what if they have not chosen the law? According to this Article 26, if the parties have not chosen the law to regulate their matrimonial property regime, it will be the law of their first habitual residence after the marriage, which will regulate their matrimonial property regime. I'm not really sure if an Italian woman and a Swedish man would be very happy to have Azerbaijani law applied to their matrimonial property regime, especially as this country was their temporary home. It's a country of totally different culture in itself, and a country with which they don't have any specific links, especially of the fact that they lived there at some period of time. This is the reason to consider the importance of the choice of law if we have intra-EU couples which intend to deal with their divorce later on in Europe, which is a logical will, and applying the law which is relevant to their situation. There are, of course, exceptions in the regulation allowing at a certain point to still to prove to the court that Azerbaijani law should not be applied. But still, again, it's additional litigation, additional efforts for the parties, and the certain level of unsure situation still remains. So let me go back to my final thoughts as I see the time is running up. As you see, the regulation foresees party autonomy, and the parties can indeed choose to a certain extent the court that will be solving their matrimonial property issues, as well as the law which will be applied. However, there are certain things that we have to remember in addition to that. When dealing with European private international family law, we necessarily have to take into account the interplay of various European Union legal instruments. Matrimonial property issues rarely come alone. Mostly they come together with divorce, maintenance, parental responsibilities, and to navigate between those instruments, it's not always easy. As to the choice of law, it is possible to choose the law in certain situations. However, we have to again take into account that in certain situations, this will of the parties will not come into life. The superior objective of concentration of jurisdiction is pursued by the regulation. Another thing is which relates to the party autonomy to choose the applicable law is the thing that is much wider in the EU regulation, and it's also an important part, especially if you have a couple which moves between jurisdictions between their lifetime. It is not a very uncommon situation nowadays, and as regulation is being started only to apply recently by courts, there is still limited case law. We are still to see how the situations will be solved, will be resolved by court when we will have such couples whose first habitual residence were somewhere in Azerbaijan or Saudi Arabia. Finally, we should remember that the regulation foresees certain balancing measures as well, such as overriding mandatory provisions, public policy rules for protection of the weaker party. This issue have to be considered when preparing to prepare agreement for the parties. The parties would specify the law applicable to their matrimonial property regulation. I would like to stop here, but before I give the floor to other speakers, I want to use this opportunity and shortly tell you about the upcoming project that some of you might be interested in. In April, five academic institutions from five European countries will start implementing a EU co-funded project, e-training on EU family property regime, so short name is EU-FAMPRO. I was allowed to do short advertising for this project, so I'm using the possibility of it. Within this project, the team of researchers will develop and run a free online course, online training for lawyers and other professionals on the EU matrimonial property rules. In a couple of months, the website, which you see here below, we'll have more information on that, but before that, if you're interested, you can either follow this website or simply send me an email so I can later on provide you information how to register for the training. So with such advertising, I'm finishing my talk and would like to thank you all for your attention.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I am just putting up my slide, which I hope you can all see. I'm going to talk about divorce and financial splits in England and give an essential outline. First, on observation, there are well over 6,500 lawyers in England and Wales that practice exclusively in family law. Whilst this covered those that specialised solely in the law relating to children, whether domestically or internationally, there are many thousands of lawyers that deal primarily with separating couples, for whom much of their time is spent in dealing with divorces and financial splits. This should give you some idea of the potential scale of issues a divorcing couple in England and Wales may need to navigate. And so this talk will necessarily be a whistle-stop tour through the legal framework, divorces, financial, and a brief look at nuptial agreements. There are a number of areas where the approach adopted in England differs significantly from other countries and indeed our closest neighbours, and these will come clear as our panel unfolds today. From the outset, it's worth noting that we're discussing only two countries in the UK here, England and Wales. Scotland and Northern Ireland have their own family law frameworks, though there are some interconnecting laws. The legal framework for divorce and financial splits comes from the Matrimonial Causes Act 1973, which has had a couple of modifications since then. Our procedures are far more modern, and the Family Procedure Rules 2010 cover all aspects of family law. Whatever court deals with the case, proceedings take place in the family court and apply the same procedural framework and rules to divorce and financial cases. It's case law and judicial decisions that make up the vast bulk of progress and change, with principles emerging that guide judges and look to address current thinking on key issues and themes. Divorces here in England are almost exclusively a paperwork exercise and are dealt with at county court level of judge. The county courts are a regional network of around 170 courts across the country. We've a relatively new online service for divorce, which also works well and aims to simplify and streamline the process of divorcing couples. This is a really welcome move for all of us specialising in the field. Financial cases will also be dealt with at county court level of judge, unless there are significant assets or very complex issues, in which case an application can be made for the matter to be heard by a judge at the High Court in London. The aspiration is for almost all cases to be determined by the court which first hears the case. But where a party wishes to challenge a decision, there's a tightly managed appeal process, which is staged through the Court of Appeal and can, on very rare occasions, progress up to the Supreme Court. In relation to divorce, there's an absolute bar in England and Wales to a divorce taking place until the parties have been married for a year. There are other potential routes available to couples, such as annulment, but they're beyond the scope of today's talk and are rarely seen. Jurisdiction is based primarily on either the habitual residence or domicile of the parties. Domicile in England and the UK can be based on origin, dependency, or choice. It is different from the US domicile or domicile seen in some European countries. It's a complex concept that requires careful thought, and in international cases, consideration of issues of taxation and more. Divorce proceedings represent the gateway to financial claims on marriage for almost all situations. And as we'll see shortly, England has a broad and generous approach to asset and income distribution, which can make securing or avoiding English jurisdiction on divorce a key question for those who may have the option of divorcing elsewhere. The case is issued after the 1st of January 2021. The Liz Pendens rule relating to EU signatory countries no longer applies. And the UK's request to join the Lugano Convention 2007 has still not been approved by the EU, though Switzerland provided its formal approval last week, which is seen as a really good starting point. This leaves the principle of forum non conveniens governing situations where divorce proceedings have been issued in two countries. Now, there's only one ground for divorce in England and Wales, that a marriage has broken down irretrievably. This currently needs to be proved by citing one of the five facts listed on this slide. Currently, unless a couple has been separated for at least 2 years, after which point they can consensually divorce, they must rely on the other party's unreasonable behaviour or adultery. Unreasonable behaviour has a subjective interpretation and usually a very low bar in application. Since the mid-1990s, attempts have been made to reform divorce law in England and Wales. The case of Owens in 2018, where the court refused a lady in her late 60s permission to divorce her husband on the basis of his unreasonable behaviour, which was very unreasonable, was used to spearhead the reform through, and happily, the Divorce, Dissolution and Separation Act 2020 is expected to become law in autumn this year. This will strip out the need for a divorcing couple to prove that a marriage has broken down irretrievably. The court will accept the statement by one or both of them a merit is broken down irretrievably without having to prove it by one of the five facts. Defended divorces will hopefully become a thing of the past, or at least a rare event, and they'll only be possible on challenges of jurisdiction, the validity of the marriage, fraud or coercion, or procedural non-compliance. Divorce proceedings occur by way of a petition or application to the court. The divorce petition contains all necessary information regarding the marriage and its breakdown and proceeds administratively through the court system. There are two key pronouncements in the process: the decree nisi, which follows the judicial consideration of the paperwork, and an announcement in open court, which is not attended by the parties, and the decree absolute, which is the final decree and point at which the parties are legally divorced. This can be applied for 6 clear weeks after the pronouncement of decree nisi and is dealt with by the court office. You'll note reference to the start of financial proceedings after decree nisi. This does not relate to contested financial proceedings, which can begin at the point the divorce is issued by the court, but consensual applications for the ratification of agreements between divorcing couples. The pronouncement of decree nisi triggers the court's ability to approve financial orders. And so on to financial claims. Firstly, the English court applies its own law and legal principles wherever the parties originate, have their closest connections, and whatever they may have agreed in a marriage contract or other document relating to their marriage. We'll come on to look at nuptial agreements shortly, but this approach differs from several other countries and can come as a surprise to international couples who find themselves divorcing in England. The court looks at all assets and resources wherever they're held in the world. In high-value cases, trusts and offshore structures are frequently encountered, often entered into as part of tax and generational wealth planning rather than in the context of a divorce. And that has become very, very prevalent in England in what's been a regularly changing taxation framework over the years. There's an absolute duty of full and frank disclosure of all financial assets. That obligation exists on all parties, and the court can impose heavy punishments and reverse decisions where a party is dishonest in their disclosure. The court has a discretionary jurisdiction, which allows it to make a very broad range of orders to fit the circumstances of any case. There's also no official property regime under English law. And whilst an individual retains absolute autonomy over assets in their name during the marriage, the court has very wide-ranging powers to transfer those assets or order their sale and division on divorce. If assets are disposed of in the context of a divorce, with a view to defeating a divorce claim, the court can look to set aside transactions or add back the money lost so as to ensure fairness. The principles relating to finance and divorce also apply to finances on the dissolution of civil partnerships, which are now finally open to same-sex couples who do not wish to marry. There is no obligation on a couple to deal with the financial aspects of their separation through the court, though the court must ratify the terms of any settlement reached. A couple have a number of different routes available to them, from direct discussions with minimal legal input, through mediation, solicitor-based collaborative law or negotiations, and onto court or arbitration, which for this purpose, arbitration is primarily used as a streamlined and private court. Arbitration is very much on the rise for high-value divorces and parental children's disputes, and is an excellent forum which has the backing and support of the family court, most recently endorsed by the Court of Appeal in a case called Haley. In dealing with financial claims, the court must look at all of the circumstances in the case. It has very wide powers to deal with capital, property, maintenance, pensions, and variation of settlements. Where these assets or interests lie beyond the court's jurisdiction, the court will look to impose obligations on the parties themselves generally to ensure compliance. But enforcement can often be a very significant issue when dealing with foreign assets, and an early evaluation of enforcement of issues is imperative in such cases. Whilst the court must look at all of the circumstances in the case, it has particular regard to a shopping list of matters that are set out here. The first can be described as what is there, the rest are factual, and what they mean to the outcome of a case will depend on each occasion. Judicial decisions are focused on various themes or topics which stem from this list and on which there is a great body of case law, and on which lawyers have spent and do spend huge amounts of time arguing for or against here in England. Financial claims on divorce are approached in two stages. Firstly, the computation stage, what is there? And secondly, the distribution stage, how should what there is be divided between the parties? Whilst there's no property regime in place, the court will assess whether assets should be described as matrimonial or non-matrimonial. Assets that were owned prior to the party's marriage, or those received through inheritance, will often be argued to be non-matrimonial or not belonging to the marriage partnership. Assets acquired or built up during the marriage, or those used heavily by the parties during the course of the marriage, will often be argued as being matrimonial or part of the matrimonial acquest. The reason for this distinction and the significant amount of time spent arguing about the classification of assets is that the starting point in financial claims here in England is that matrimonial assets are shared equally between the divorcing couple, and that principle will apply whatever the quantum of the asset base, subject to a small number of reasons that can be deployed for a departure from the 50-50 division. These include special contribution where the wealth is very high. Non-matrimonial assets should only feature to the extent that they are required to achieve fairness, most usually to meet the financial needs of one party. Now, financial needs is not needs as you might know it in your own jurisdiction. As a concept, it's particularly elastic in England. It can extend to many millions of pounds and facilitate lavish lifestyles in certain cases where the assets are very high. Compensation allows the court to provide an enhanced award to a spouse who has given up a very lucrative career to care for the family, thus allowing the other party to continue to build a very successful and lucrative career. It's only been successfully argued in a very small number of cases and is rarely deployed. We've already had a fantastic overview of income claims from Roxanne earlier this afternoon, and so all that I'll say in relation to this aspect is that the English approach to ongoing maintenance requirements and its powers extend far beyond those of many other countries in both quantum and length. The court has an obligation to achieve a clean break between a divorcing couple, meaning the end of their financial ties together, save for any financial links concerning children, be that child maintenance or educational provision. But where there is insufficient capital for the party's needs to be met and an income disparity, the court can and will impose ongoing spousal maintenance. This can be for a term, years not months, or indefinite, and the only absolute guarantee of maintenance ending comes on the remarriage of the receiving party or on death, though claims can still be brought against an estate if the paying party passes away. Now, briefly on nuptial agreements, they're not contractually binding on parties in England, nor do they bind the court. The court will decide what weight should be given to the terms of the agreement at the time of any divorce. This can range from no weight at all to a full endorsement of the terms agreed between them. They are, however, relatively common, especially for those of us with international and high asset clients, and can be very effective in limiting claims and uncertainty of those claims that divorce can bring. They're prepared by family lawyers in general, and the court has given guidance as to what would be expected of them if they are to be given particular weight within subsequent proceedings. The K&K checklist gives the following base requirements for a nuptial agreement to be likely to be afforded proper weight. And the Rademacher decision shifted responsibilities from the wealthier party to a more even responsibility between each party, so that if each knows what rights they may be giving up and have had sufficient information to make an informed decision, they should know and be advised that they are likely to be held to agreement that they are entering into, absent vitiating factors such as duress. Nuptial agreements in England tend to focus on the provision to be made at the time of divorce, rather than the financial or other arrangements during marriage. They also tend to focus on provision that would otherwise be made by the court on divorce, rather than include any punitive type provisions to deal with bad behaviour or conduct. They deal with the practical issues surrounding separation and financial provision to be made, if any. They can't limit financial provision to be sought for children, nor deal with the arrangements for the care of children on separation. And that is a whistle-stop tour of divorce and financial splits here in England.
Thank you very much, Sam and Agne. Let's travel now to Switzerland. I've prepared just one page paper with the outline of the presentation, and I will begin with some preliminary remarks. I wanted to take just 1 minute to evoke with you the particular situation of Switzerland, geographically right in the middle of Europe, but as you all know, out of the European Union and all its family law regulation.
Nevertheless, we are party of to a lot of multilateral conventions applying in international family law with country in Europe and outside Europe, as the Hague Convention of 73, the Hague Convention of 1896, and also, for example, the Lugano Convention. But as to the liquidation of assets, no multilateral convention has been signed by Switzerland, which means it is a very national or domestic field. Consequently, you cannot avoid consulting a Swiss lawyer as long as Switzerland is concerned by a case. And maybe then warning your client of large bills to come, all by usually smaller than those of UK lawyers we see. So as to the international situation involving liquidation of assets, we will apply our PILA, Private International Law Act. And regarding the jurisdiction, but also applicable law and recognition in Switzerland, it is always crucial to correctly qualify the topic you are considering, distinguishing the liquidation of the marital property regime from maintenance issues. The question is relevant in relation both, for example, to Great Britain and to France. Should, for example, the English equitable distribution be considered as alimony or marital property? And what about also the prestation compensatoire in France, the compensatory allowance? The consequences of the qualification are considerable, since, for instance, if it is maintenance, the Lugano Convention will be applied for jurisdiction and recognition in relation to other country members of this convention. But if it is a question of liquidation of a marital regime, our PILA will only be applied. So then I will just detail the Swiss international private rules only linked to the strict topic of the liquidation of assets in the frame of a divorce. So as to the jurisdiction first, according to our PILA, the jurisdiction to rule on the liquidation of the marital property regime exists if the court has jurisdiction to rule on the principle of divorce. So the following authorities have jurisdiction for both divorce and liquidation of assets. First, the Swiss courts at the defendant domicile, and second, the Swiss court at the petitioner's domicile, if he has resided in Switzerland for 1 year at least, or if he's a Swiss citizen. There is also a subsidiary jurisdiction, but I have no time now to talk about this. Maybe two precision important as to the jurisdiction. First, according to our PILA, in matters involving an economic interest, so in general, the party may agree on the court that will have jurisdiction, provided they've put it in writing. So we are talking here about an election of four. Secondly, the Swiss judge may be seized of a request for the liquidation of the marital property regime in the particular context of a proceeding to supplement a foreign divorce judgment. So in fact, in order to complete a foreign divorce judgment. For example, one can imagine a divorce pronounced, for example, in Russia, I mean a decision rendered only on the sole principle of divorce, and then a petition sent to the Swiss judge to complete this divorce judgment, for example, ruling on the liquidation of property regime. As to the applicable law, according to PILA, the general rule is that the marital property regime should be governed by the law chosen by the spouses, and I will come back to this talking about the marriage contract. In absence of a choice of law, according to PILA, the marital property regime should be governed by, first, the law of the state in which both spouses are domiciled simultaneously, or if it's not the case, the law of the states in which both spouses were last domiciled at the same time. So I think it's quite an interesting element of private international law, since in practice, It is very, very common that only one of the spouses is living in Switzerland and that the last common domicile has been in another state. Thus, we are often led to apply a foreign law in matters of liquidation of the marital regime, which could be, for instance, the law of the United Arab Emirates if the spouses last live together in Dubai, unless obviously it violates public order. So strategically, Switzerland can therefore easily be a place of habitual residence chosen by one spouse in order to try to have a more favorable foreign law applying, and not Swiss law, but another one applying to the liquidation of the marital property regime. As to the recognition, in the absence of a convention between Switzerland and the state concerned, decisions on marital regime are submitted to PILA as to their recognition. And the question of the recognition of foreign order in Switzerland is, I would say, particularly important because of the frequent presence of assets of international families here in Switzerland, such as bank accounts or secondary residence, a lot of chalet, for example, in the mountains. So in order to obtain an urgent freezing of assets, for example, it is sometimes necessary to also request the recognition of the foreign decision as a preliminary step. So according to PILA, foreign decision concerning the marital property regime should be recognized in Switzerland quite easily, as long as there is a sufficient link between the court that rule on the property regime and the spouses. But I give you a counter example, a decision rendered in the states of which neither spouse or only the plaintiff spouse is a citizen should not be recognized in Switzerland if the defendant had his habitual residence in Switzerland and if he opposed to the foreign jurisdiction. And that's also, I think, a very important point to keep in mind if you have Swiss situation, because you may advise your client in your own country to formally oppose to the jurisdiction for divorce, even there is jurisdiction in your country, but with the sole objective for your client to be able to then oppose to the recognition of this decision in Switzerland, and consequently to be able to file his own petition for divorce in Switzerland, even if the foreign court had been seized before. So then I will just come quite quickly to the property regimes in Switzerland. Swiss law provides, in fact, three marital property regime. The first one and the most important one is the participation in acquired property. So it is the default Swiss marital property regime, which always applies when the spouses have not made a specific choice for an alternative regime in a marital contract agreement. So under this regime, there is a distinction between the individual property, including assets belonging to a spouse before the marriage or acquired later by gift or inheritance, and acquisition, which includes assets acquired mainly through work or income from individual property during the marriage. In the case of divorce, the dissolution of the marital property regime occurs on the day on which the petition was filed, and then each spouse recovers their individual property, and is also entitled to half the value of the other spouse acquisition, less half of the value of their own acquisition. It seems like this very simple, but as you can all imagine, it's the exact contrary, and there are a lot of rules of compensation and other specificities that make the calculation, in fact, in practice, very complicated. The second matrimonial Swiss regime is the separation of property. In this case, the marriage has no effect on the spouse's assets. So each spouse is entitled to freely dispose of their asset and to transfer them to a third person, company, or a trustee. except the family home, which is protected by a special marital legal provisions and require the agreement of the other spouse. So in case of the divorce, a division of property is not necessary and each spouse retains their assets and there are no monetary compensation claims between spouses, but there are some exceptions again. Then there is a third one, but I will not talk about this because I saw it in practice, I think two times in during the last 12 years. So it's really something unusual. As to the marriage contract now, first about international rules applying in Switzerland. The spouses may choose to be submitted as to their property regime to the law of the state in which they are both domiciled or will be domiciled following the marriage ceremony, or the law of the state of which one of the spouses is a citizen. So for example, if one spouse is Ukrainian, for example, and both spouses decided by written agreement to be submitted to Ukrainian law as to their property regime, Switzerland will, and it's mandatory, recognize this choice and apply only Ukrainian law at the time of the Swiss divorce as to the liquidation of assets. As to the form and effects, the choice of law must be agreed in written or be clearly evident from the marital agreement. And again, to be sure that a marriage contract will be recognized in Switzerland later in case of a divorce in this country, it is very important to consult a Swiss lawyer before the signature of the contract to be sure everything is in order. As to internal law, a marital agreement may be concluded in Switzerland before or after the wedding. The spouses may choose set aside or modify their marital property regime only within the limits of the law, and I've described before the three three matrimonial regime. And last but not least, the marital agreement must be executed as a public deed and signed by the party. So you will have noticed, for example, that there is no need for a spouse to receive an independent legal advice before signing. And also there is no restriction as to the date of the signing of the contract, which can take place, for example, the day before or even the date of the wedding. Then, and it's the last element I wanted to discuss with you, but it's again very important in international cases involving Switzerland, it's the occupational pension assets. So in Switzerland, the old age provision is based on a system called the three pillar principles. And I'm talking here only about the second one, so the occupational pensions assets. In Switzerland, it is mandatory also both employer and employee must contribute to a pension scheme, and the amounts could be really, really very high, depending obviously of the salary and the numbers of years concerned. But since one of the spouse in an international situation was an employee in Switzerland during the marriage, he may most probably still have funds in a Swiss pension funds because it's difficult to take the funds out. So as to the international rules linked to this, those assets in hands of pension funds, since the 1st of January 2017, the Swiss court have exclusive jurisdiction over compensation for pension entitlements against a Swiss occupational pension funds. And the judge will apply only exclusively Swiss law. So for you, this means that even if you find an agreement in your own country on the divorce and its accessory effects, and thus also about the assets in the hands of the Swiss pension fund, this foreign agreement judgment cannot and will never be recognized like this in Switzerland. It will therefore be necessary to go through the proceedings to complete the foreign divorce judgment. And in these proceedings, the Swiss judge will apply Swiss law. So very quickly, what Swiss law says about the splitting of those occupational pension assets in principle, each spouse has a right has a right to half of the retirement benefits saved by the other spouse during the course of the marriage until the petition for divorce is filed. So there are some exceptions, and spouses may agree on something different, but with very important limits. So thank you very much, and I let the floor to Séverine, I think.
Yes, thank you. Hello, everybody. Thank you, William. You're a great team leader, I must say. I'm going to be lazy and just assume that France has got jurisdiction as far as splitting of assets is concerned, and will rely on Agnès, I guess, and everything she said before. So that would be my starting point. Let me just see if I can work that. Yeah, is that okay? Yeah. Can you see my slide or I'm not sure? Yes, okay. You may know that in France, we just very recently had major reform on divorce. On divorce law, although this was a divorce reform of divorce proceeding law and did not really affect substantive rules, although it will in practice also probably affect the overall economy of divorces. We have the goal of this reform was to make things simpler, shorter. To condense the proceedings. Before we had three stages in divorce proceedings. First was interim financial measures. Then we had the divorce decree and allocation of any compensatory benefits. And then we had the splitting of assets. So those were three steps. Now we are left with only two steps, which are the interim, which decree and compensation altogether, just one stage, and then the splitting of assets. So hopefully this will make the process slightly shorter, although it's not sure at all. Basically, as a result of this, there is no connection, there's still no connection today, even after this reform, between the determination of compensation benefits and the splitting of assets. And from this absence of connection, we happen to encounter quite substantial problems, especially in international cases. The compensation is most likely to be a lump sum. It's a very subjective matter. Us as lawyers, we have no idea how the courts end up with the numbers they come up with. Our Supreme Court wants it to be like this, actually, and it is based on various criteria. So this is usually a lump sum decided by the court. And once the divorce is pronounced, then we have the phase of the splitting of assets. This is a phase that has to, first of all, involve an amicable phase. Attempt to find an agreement. And this phase occurs before a notary. The court has, at this stage, nothing to do with it, and parties should be able to agree on how to split the assets with the help of a notary. But the notary will be bound by the marriage contract and the notary and the judge later on, if the notary is not successful, has no discretion on the enforcement of a prenup. And that's a major difference with a lot of other jurisdiction. So splitting of assets will see that we have to apply strict rules of our code civil. It's some almost like mathematical rules, regardless of the prenups. The First, just very quickly, the particularities of our property agreements, which are a little similar to Swiss ones. But first of all, they're drafted by notaries. They cannot be drafted by lawyers. And they must precede the marriage. And there is, which is what is very important, is that there is no representation by a lawyer. There's no obligation to be represented by a lawyer. So you could be end up two foreigners or one foreigner and a French person could end up in front of a notary with a French speaking notary and the non-French ones or the weaker spouse would end up signing something with no legal representation. Very often in front of a notary, that's the family notary of the wealthiest spouse. So that's it's this idea that our notaries are neutral, but this has its limits. And there is also no obligation in our marriage contracts to list the assets, and that's also a big difference. So, of course, all these particularities, they end up in difficulties of interpretation and enforcement, and especially enforcement outside France. The principle is the freedom of the spouses to draft prenups as they may fit, as they see fit, provided that the agreement is not contrary to public policy provisions. But an important thing is that parties cannot contractually and in advance organize all the financial consequences of their divorce, and they certainly cannot decide on the compensation benefits that one of them would have at the end if a divorce occurs. And that's a very important point that sometimes foreigners have difficulties to admit and to understand. So we have four main property regimes. I will not get into details of each of them. They definitely don't have time. There is by contract, the participation, the main one is the separation regime, which is sort of similar to the English regime, separation regime, although there are many differences and problems occur while implementing agreements because French notaries intend to think that it's a similar concept, the English one and the French one of separation, and it's not really. So there are difficulties of interpretation. If there are other contracts, I will not get into, but those contracts are very often standards. They are not they're not customized or self-tailored. We often see exactly the same contracts coming one case after the other. I mean, notaries are not, I'm sorry, I hope there's no but they're not, at least they were not in cases now that are coming for divorce, they were not that sophisticated in France when drafting the prenups. Unfortunately, because that's at the end that we find the problems. If there are no contracts, then the spouses are married under what are deemed to have opted implicitly for the community of assets regime. So when divorcing, all assets that have been bought, acquired, and created during the marriage by one or both spouses are considered community assets. And on the winding up of the matrimonial regime, each spouse will receive the property which belongs to them personally and half of the value of the community property. And of course, there'll be, like in Swiss law, there'll be additional financial compensations depending on if a spouse, for example, has invested more has invested some personal money in the community asset. This community regime is that's interesting. It is quite similar to the Californian property regime, and I've had a case. I have a case where I had to study in depth the Californian property regime, and it's quite similar, but there are some interesting differences. that I'm trying to explain to the Court of Appeal here of X. We'll see if they agree with what I'm saying. So now, just a couple of things specifically on in international cases, because that's what interests all of us. When, for example, two non-French nationals are divorcing in France, you could have a different law applying to the divorce, which is the decree, like I explained before, the decree and the compensation allowance, and to the splitting of assets. So there'll be two different laws, and it will be that most likely the French law will govern the divorce, and a foreign law would govern the splitting of assets. And that may create some quite important imbalances and antagonists way to deal with the various aspects of the divorce case. So how is the applicable law to the splitting determined? So of course we apply international and national rules of international jurisdiction. The first residence of the couple would of course determine the applicable law very often. This in itself can be a major problem because of course it could take maybe a couple of years for a French court to decide where is the first residence of the couple, of the foreign couple who got married in Greece, for example, and then first lived in England for 2 months and then moved to France and bought properties in France. And also what is important is the declaration. When foreigners buy properties in France, they notaries don't often understand the importance of the way they qualify the matrimonial regime in the deed. And this is something that we intend to use afterwards to decide which law will apply to the splitting of assets, you know, what the notary said. But unfortunately, sometimes what was said is not necessarily what should have been said. So as a result, French courts might have to apply foreign law. So then how do they do that? Well, it's when we come into the picture. Because us as lawyers, we have to explain foreign law to the French court. And it's not necessarily a problem when there's a lot of, like when clients have the means and can get legal opinions from foreign lawyers. And it is much more difficult when the clients do not have necessarily the means to employ foreign lawyers and all sorts of experts to expose. So sometimes it just comes to us, to try to. So I've had to translate, for example, to translate some to have some pieces of foreign codes translated and try to explain to the court how they should have, how it should be applied. Another situation where problems can occur is when people have divorced abroad and they're splitting properties that are located in France. That is really when the fun begins, if I may say, because if the singularities of our system here with notaries and all our legal frame has not been taken into consideration in the divorce outside France, then it could create major, major problems here, because the notary here is just going to look at, first of all, the marriage contract. And if it's a French marriage contract, they would want to strictly apply the marriage contract. So if the divorce hasn't taken the marriage contract into consideration outside France, then it would be a problem. I've had various cases where it's been years and years trying to split a property here in France after a foreign divorce, and not necessarily a contested divorce, or even if people have agreed abroad, they have agreed that their summer house in south of France was going to be given to one of the spouses. That's not that easy. It's just not you go to a notary and say, well, I'd like the property title to be transferred to me. It doesn't work like this. And there are difficulties and costs involved. Just finally, I'm just trying to cut because I'm running out of time. I just wanted to emphasize on the cost of splitting assets in France, because that's something that foreign clients have a hard time with. They've gone down, I'm talking about taxes to start with, where we had a tax of 2.5% on all assets. It's gone down this year to 1.8%, and it will go down to 1.1% in January 2020. So it's a good thing that it's going down, but it could be the foreign clients have a major problem with this, because then you have also the notary fees, so that can come up to 4% of the total equity of the assets to be split. Now, just wanted to finish on the idea of fairness, because my dream is what I hear is like fairness in Anglo-Saxon jurisdiction and the principle and fairness as a safeguard. And unfortunately, here in France, we are far away from this. Although our Supreme Court keeps saying that that the division of assets in France is even by nature. I don't think it is in the end. So in reality, it's very different, especially in international cases. Like I said, the French courts do not have discretionary power. So there is no such thing as equitable distribution or equalization. And also, I will finish with this, the fact that there is this difference in time that compensation and splitting, divorce compensation and splitting of assets happen in different moments in time. Sometimes it could be 10 years between the two. It creates lots of problems, obviously. And also the fact that the court might end up ruling after a few years. You still have to go back to the notary to have the splitting of assets implemented. So then starts another phase. Here we have to wait about 2 years, three years for a case to be heard before the specialized chamber of our Court of Appeal when it comes to splitting assets. So it's not an easy process, and best is work on agreements, especially in international cases. Most of the time, only an agreement can take clients out of the deadlock. I'm finished, I guess.
Okay, I think that I can continue or start my presentation. So first of all, I would like to thank the organization committee for putting this event. And I'm really sorry that we were not able to make our event in person, but still hope that in a few years we will be able to meet personally in Kyiv and to host another European chapter meeting. So to start with, I would like to deal today with Ukrainian issues concerning divorce and financial splits. And first of all, I would like to describe some special features concerning divorce in Ukraine that involves foreign jurisdictions. And then I will speak a little bit about the recent Ukrainian court practice concerning division of property. So first of all, I would like to explain that Ukraine is among the countries that can easily grant a divorce without considering financial and children issues. So that means that you can have a divorce in Ukraine without financial and children settlement. Usually divorce proceedings are very fast. So you can have a divorce within 3-4 months after submitting a claim. You don't need to prove any special reasons why you want to divorce, and the court will not investigate the reason for divorce. So it is usually enough to say that our marriage has broken down. We don't love each other. We don't want to continue to live together. That's why we are asking for divorce. And if the spouses want to have financial and children settlement, they are always free to file a separate appeal and to consider their financial and children issue in a separate claims. That means that in Ukraine, usually we have a separate divorce proceeding that is formal, very fast, with no special reason. And separately, we could have divorce, property division and financial and children settlement proceeding. Another important point is that if Ukrainian court was sized for divorce, it does not mean that it will automatically get jurisdiction to consider children and financial issues. Because if you will apply to consider children and financial issues, the general rules on jurisdiction will be that you should apply to the court where the respondent resides. And if the respondent is a foreigner that resides, for instance, in USA or England, you would not be able to apply to Ukrainian court. And then you should go to England or to US courts in order to settle your children and financial issues or to divide the property. I would like to describe you the recent case. We were engaged in this case and it concerned a divorce between a husband and a wife. So basically both of spouses, they were Ukrainians and they married in Ukraine in June 2007. Their son was born during the marriage in Ukraine. But in 2011, wife decided to move with their son to London for permanent residence because the father wanted that the son educated in London. So it is very popular right now among Ukrainian rich people, governmental oligarchs to educate their children in London. And wife agreed and she moved with the son to London and father stayed basically in Ukraine, but sometimes he traveled to London. So in general, he shared his time between Kyiv and London. And during this period, of course, husband purchased high value property in London on his name and it was purchased during the marriage. Their marriage has broken down after 2016. And of course, wife decided to file for divorce. At that point of time, she had acquired English citizenship. And of course, it was more beneficial for her to have a divorce and financial settlement in England, because as Sam explained us, England is very beneficial jurisdiction to have a divorce, especially when the property is located in England and based on the principles that are applied during divorce proceeding, the wife could really get a very good share in a joint property. So the wife filed for divorce in England on the 1st October 2018. And 3 days later, husband filed for divorce in Ukraine. And Ukrainian proceeding was opened on 19th of October 2018. So basically, approximately within the same time, they initiated divorce proceeding in Ukraine and England. And of course, English lawyers that advise the wife, they needed to suspend Ukrainian divorce proceeding. Otherwise, it could have a negative consequences concerning English divorce proceeding and financial settlement. So our task was to suspend and close Ukrainian divorce proceeding. And frankly speaking, it was not an easy task. Although you might think that so everything is clear. The first court was sized in England and Ukrainian court should close the proceeding. But the fact is that Ukrainian court is very formal. The judges, they rarely receive the documents from other jurisdictions. And for instance, procedural documents issued in England are different from procedural documents that are issued in Ukraine. And in England, you simply file divorce application or financial settlement application, and that is considered that you have commenced the proceeding. In Ukraine, the situation is different because you file divorce application and then the court issues special ruling confirming that divorce has been commenced. So we had the problems to prove that divorce proceeding was actually commenced in England because the first instant court thought that it is not enough simply to demonstrate application for divorce. And our arguments were as following, that Ukrainian court has no jurisdiction to consider divorce claim as she and the child hold English citizenship. They permanently reside in England and England court has already commenced divorce proceeding. The second argument is that under Ukrainian law, we have a special provision in civil procedural code and the law Ukraine on international private law saying that if a divorce proceeding has been opened in a foreign jurisdiction between the same parties on the same grounds and for the same reason, then Ukrainian court shall close the divorce proceeding. And of course, we apply to this provision arguing that the court in Ukraine should close the divorce proceeding. The next argument was that the wife might not have effective financial remedy in Ukraine because she has intention to receive financial settlement in England that was more beneficial for her. And financial settlement was inseparable from English divorce proceeding. And we tried to persuade the judge that if Ukrainian divorce will stay in place, she will simply lose effective remedies in English to divide the property that was located in England. What was the husband arguments? So the husband argued that we did not provide reliable evidence that the proceeding was commenced in England. They argued that divorce application was not sufficient to demonstrate that there was ongoing divorce proceeding. They argued that allegedly they were not aware about the divorce proceeding commenced in England. And allegedly they argued that under Ukrainian law, it is Ukrainian judge should suspend proceeding only if similar divorce proceeding are initiated within the territory of Ukraine.
Irina, I hate to interrupt your interesting talk. You'll have to wind up in about 3 to 4 minutes, in about 3 minutes time, preferably.
Yeah, okay. So
I'm sorry to do that to a Kiev panelist.
Yeah. So I will try to limit my presentation. Another argument on his side was that the parties hold Ukrainian citizenship, they have registered place of residence of Ukraine, immovable property, so the Ukrainian court has jurisdiction to hear the case. And what was the first instant decision? The first instant court favored husband's position and granted the divorce on the 1st February 2018. So the judge said that I'm not satisfied with your evidence. I consider that I have jurisdiction and I will grant you divorce. After that, on 20th of March 2019, English court granted final divorce decree absolute. So the spouses were divorced twice. And of course, we decided to challenge the first instant court and went to appeal. And appeal was successful. And we employed the following arguments, as I described previously. And the findings of the appeal court was as following. So the arguments about parties' nationality and their registered place of residence were neutral and shall be dismissed. The divorce proceeding cannot take place in two jurisdictions and regard should be paid to the jurisdiction that was sized first. In our case, in England, divorce proceeding was commenced on the 1st October 2018. That was 18 days earlier than in Ukraine. And for this reason, the first instant court was obliged to close Ukrainian divorce proceeding based on our local law and on a civil procedural code. first instance decision was cancelled and the husband divorce application was dismissed. After that, the husband decided to lodge a cassation and the case went to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court upheld the decision of the first instance court ordering that Ukrainian divorce proceedings should be suspended. So this case was successful for our client, but we have certain conclusions and lessons that should be made from this case. So first of all, when we are dealing with cross-border divorce and proceedings in different states, we should take into account difference in procedural law and difference in procedural documents that might be issued. And of course, we should take into account that, for instance, in Ukraine, the courts are very formal and sometimes it is very difficult to prove even that there is an ongoing court proceeding in another state. In our portfolio, we had like another case that concerns US jurisdiction, but that case was not such successful because in that case, the husband filed for divorce in Ukraine and he was granted with a Ukrainian divorce.
Can I give you 1 minute, Irina?
Yeah, okay, and unfortunately his wife was deprived then of her right to commence divorce proceeding in California state because there was already divorce order issued in Ukraine. And that as well affected her financial remedies. So she could not divide the property that was located in United States. So if you have on your map Ukraine, so be careful because you might one day face Ukrainian divorce proceeding that might create obstacles in the financial settlement between the parties. So I would like to thank you for your time. And of course, I'm open for any additional questions.
Okay, we won't have time for questions, but thank you to all the panelists for a fantastic overview from many different jurisdictions and for bringing today's formal proceedings to an end. And now I'm gonna hand over to Tom Sasser, who's the president-elect, and Rachel and Suzanne, and we're going to close the conference.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for attending this fabulous program put on by the European chapter. This introduction to European family law program has been something that has been a program that has gone on almost every year since 2015. I want to take this moment specifically to thank Suzanne Todd and William Healing for the work that they've done over the years from Berlin to Madrid to Milan, to Warsaw, and then to our virtual conference today. You all have done a fabulous job. We hope that many of you who've attended today who are not fellows of the IAFL will consider joining. Our president, Marlene Moses, wishes she could be here with us today, but she was unable to attend, so I am her emissary. But please consider applying to the International Academy. The kind of programming, education, the exchange of ideas that you heard today is exactly what the International Academy is about. And having today, you may not know this, 327 participants registered for the program, 21 different speakers covering 49 different jurisdictions around the globe. That's what the organization is about. I'd also, of course, be remiss if I didn't thank the European chapter president, Rachel Kelsey, for overseeing all of this, as well as, of course, the executive director for the European chapter, Ali Massey, who is the technical wizard behind making all this happen, bringing us all in and out of programming as necessary and keeping track of us. So again, thank you so much for attending. I would be also chided if I failed to remind you, as Ali has already done, that there is a networking event following this. If you've signed up, which most of you have, you should have Zoom instructions. She also put a note, I believe, in the chat to you. So please plan to attend the networking event, which starts in about 15 minutes by Zoom. Hope that many of you will attend. There'll be small breakout rooms. So again, thank you for participating. We hope that many of you who are not fellows will apply and become fellows of the International Academy.